Luke chapter 18, and we're going to start at verse 9. Jesus also told this parable to some who trusted in themselves that they were righteous, and treated others with contempt. Two men went up into the temple to pray, one a Pharisee and the other a tax collector. The Pharisee, standing by himself, prayed thus, God, I thank you that I am not like other men, extortioners, unjust, adulterers, or even like this tax collector. I fast twice a week. I give tithes of all that I get. But the tax collector, standing far off, would not even lift up his eyes to heaven, but beat his breast, saying, God, be merciful to me, a sinner. I tell you, this man went down to his house justified rather than the other. For everyone who exalts himself will be humbled, but the one who humbles himself will be exalted.
Okay, you're swerving down country roads at about 50, 60 miles per hour. There's just enough room on the roads for two cars to get past each other, but it'd be a pretty tight squeeze, and the hedges are fairly high like you get in some parts of the country, so you can't really see if anything is coming. It's daylight, so you don't have the advantage, like you do at night, of being able to see the headlights from a long way away. And it's been raining fairly recently, so the roads are pretty dry. But every so often, there's one of those monster puddles that you get by the side of the road that allows you to send water spraying up over the fence in spectacular style. The music is blaring out of the car radio pretty loud. Let me ask you, how safe do you feel? I don't think that's a fair question, actually. I've not given you all the information that you need to answer that as a question. Because actually, there's only one piece of information, I think, that matters when it comes to how safe you feel in that sort of situation, and it is this. Who is driving the car? Because I suspect that for most of us, if the answer is you're driving, then the answer is I feel pretty good. Thank you very much. All of a sudden, that is a description of a very pleasant bit of country driving. Something particularly enjoyable about country driving, I think it's the fact you get to imagine that you're a rally driver a little bit, and you really get to sort of pump the brake, work the accelerator, thunk through the gears, that sort of thing. Most of us, I guess, if we live in London, only ever get to either drive on motorways, in which case you're just sort of cruising along, or you get to drive in London, in which case you're just sort of trundling up to the car in front of you as it moves about 10 metres forwards and repeat. But if the answer isn't you, the answer, somebody else is driving the car. Let's say it's the person sitting next to you this evening. Take a look. How safe do you feel now? All of a sudden, we feel a little bit nauseous, a little bit car sick. The knuckles get a little bit whiter. And we find ourselves trying to suppress that sharp intake of breath every often. No one ever goes like this when they're driving the car, do they? As far as we're all concerned, we are the safest driver that we know. And I think that same principle applies to all kinds of things in life. It's the thing that's been summed up in the phrase, if you want a job doing properly, do it yourself. If something happens at university or at work and you're accused of making some sort of mistake, there's a meeting to discuss the issue, who do you want to be there? You! I want to be there if it's me. Of course we do, because who is better to explain, to justify my thinking, to explain why it wasn't my fault, actually, than yourself? I've never been a defendant in court, but I imagine that it's an extremely difficult thing, actually, to sit there and have someone else stand up and speak and ask questions on your behalf. Certainly from pretty much every court drama you ever see on television, it seems like a pretty tough thing. That's why so many people stand up, don't they, I guess, in the middle of those court scenes and shout their piece themselves or have blazing rows with their pretty yet ruthless barrister about how they should proceed. This week, one of our friends was in hospital and the doctors were monitoring their progress while sort of deciding if the friend needed some sort of pretty minor operation. It was all turned out fine. In the end, but at one point during the week, our friend, who is a history teacher, was very seriously considering discharging themselves, despite the trained medical professionals who said that she wasn't yet fit to go. My apologies to anyone who's ever discharged themselves from hospital, but I think that is a pretty bold move. But it just symbolizes, doesn't it? We really don't want anybody else to be in control. No matter what the subject, I know better, and I'm very happy to rely on me. There is no one, if we're honest, in the world that we trust as much as we trust ourselves. Last week, as we started off Luke chapter 18, we were thinking about the end of the world as we thought about the parable of the persistent widow. And this little passage, this parable, follows straight on from last week. Verse 9 says, "He also," the flow goes straight through. And I think this story pushes us to ask the question, who do I trust if the world ends tomorrow? The very last verse of last week's passage says this, "Nevertheless, when the Son of Man comes, will he find faith on earth?" Will he find faith? Or I guess more to the point, what will he find faith in? Faith in what? Faith in whom? If the Son of Man came back tomorrow and said to you, "Where is your faith? Who do you trust?" I wonder what your answer would be. Because in this parable that Emma's just read for us, we are given the stark contrast between two men, two prayers, and two very different places, if you like, that we can place our trust or put our faith. One of which leads to justification, vindication, you might say, right standing, righteousness before God. And which will ultimately, our passage tells us, lead to exaltation. And one which would leave us on the last day facing utter humiliation. Firstly then, self-assured pride. To trust ourselves, the approach of the Pharisee. The Pharisee's prayer, I don't know if you noticed, it is the very epitome of self-confidence. We see that not just in what he says, but in how he says it. We're told in verse 13 that the tax collector is far off, which is in contrast, I guess, to the Pharisee, which means that the Pharisee has gone deep into the temple. He's probably gone as close to the center, as close to God, as he can possibly get. He comes before God to proclaim himself upright in standing and confidently demonstrates that by standing upright to do so. So he boldly approaches God. God, if you like, is where he thinks he belongs. And we see that because, as verse 11 tells us, he sets himself apart from other men. The very manner of his prayer demonstrates his superiority. He doesn't want to be counted alongside other people. He's not a stand amongst sort of bloke. He is a stand out from the crowd kind of guy. And he makes sure that God knows it. Just listen again as he reels off his righteousness CV. "God, I thank you that I'm not like other men, extortioners, unjust, adulterers, or even like this tax collector. I fast twice a week. I give tithes of all that I get." So the thanks go to God, you might say. But the congratulations, well, they all go to himself. Like a cyclops, this guy is all eye. He's not done the bad things that he shouldn't have done. And he has done the good things that he was supposed to have done. In fact, he's gone way over and above when it comes to doing that. The Old Testament law stipulated that people should fast once a year on the Day of Atonement. So this guy is fasting 103 times more a year than he needs to. He gives the tithe of 10%, he says, of everything he gets. Now, that is far more than the law commands, which is just to give it of certain things. We know from some extra biblical sources, in fact, that many of the Pharisees literally gave away 10% of everything they were given, including any food that they were served when they went round to somebody's house for dinner. Way over and above. And here, I think, is the thing that challenges me a little bit, because it's easy for us to caricature the Pharisee. If you've got in your mind the kind of the mental image of what this guy might have looked like, the one I have is wearing a long, dark, pretty ominous-looking robe. He's got sneaky eyes, little black pointy beard. If you're familiar with the film, he basically looks like Jafar from Aladdin. He is an obvious rotter, this man. But if we'd have known him, well, we'd have said that this guy was the most straight down the line, the most honourable, the most upright, the most moral bloke that we knew. He is the model citizen. He doesn't cheat. He looks after his family. He gives to charity. If you ask him his opinion, he tries to be as fair and as faithful as he possibly can. If you were a member of this church, he is the guy that you would go to ask advice. He is the guy that you would go to for some sort of theological clarification or with your pastoral problem. Externally, to anything that any of us could have seen, this guy would have been utterly whiter than white, unimpeachable. We would have said, yeah, this guy is a good man. But he thinks that too. Indeed, he thinks he's not just good, he thinks he's good enough. Not just good such that he's a better man morally than others, including the tax collector. Which again, I guess humanly speaking, is probably beyond question if we'd have known the two of them. But no, the Pharisee thinks he is good enough for God. He is, in the words of verse 9, right at the start there, the very example of someone who trusted in themselves that they were righteous. He thinks he is so good that he can come before God and, as it were, stand toe-to-toe with the perfect infinite, the infinitely perfect, and have nothing to answer for on the basis of his own performance and character. He would have told us, no doubt, if we were there, that God cannot abide sin. But he is so full of pride in himself that he doesn't think that he has any. Such is the irony of his self-assured self-deception. Not only blind to his unrighteousness before God, but blind to his unrighteousness in his contempt for others, this tax collector included. It is very easy for us to think that we are good enough if we use our own definition of goodness. It's very easy to be a standard bearer for morality and righteousness if you are the standard setter. It's very easy to think that I'm good enough if I don't commit certain sins that I've decided to magnify above all the other ones. I don't steal. I'm faithful to my wife. I don't do anything to hurt anyone deliberately. It's very easy to think that I'm good enough if I count the positive things that I do as some sort of credit to my righteousness account, such that even when I do good things, even when I don't think I have to, I'm upping my giving a little bit, even though I'm not under any compulsion to do so. I go and visit someone, even though it's really out of my way. I make sure I attend church every single week. If every time I do those things, or I do anything that I think is good, I think I'm topping up my righteousness tank a little bit. And it is very easy to think that I'm good enough as long as I compare myself to other people, all I ever need do is pick up the paper, flick on the television, look at the lives of people around me, and think, I would never do that. It is very easy to trust myself if I think that righteousness is a competition, and all I have to do is be near enough the top. Secondly, then, the tax collector and his self-aware humility. Tax collectors were, I guess, famously absolutely reviled in Jesus' time because they'd completely sold out to the Romans. They collected taxes for the occupying force. It's the sort of thing that you might see in a movie about Nazi-occupied France or something like that. The ordinary townsfolk are there. They're offering a kind of quiet, constant resistance. And then the camera pans over to Francois the baker. There he is, standing behind his counter, wearing his swastika and refusing to serve the Jew who's come into his shop. We're supposed to be absolutely appalled because Francois has sold out on his principles, sold out on his people for the sake of money and for the sake of his own security. And the Jewish tax collector, well, he was a bit like that. The way the system worked was that they were allowed to charge in addition to the taxes that they were collecting, because that was how their own wages were paid. And of course, in a system where you effectively set your own salary, well, most of the tax men, it seemed, like to feather their own nests extensively and extortionately at the expense of their fellow countrymen, with the protection of Rome allowing them to do so. And so the fact that the Pharisee points to the tax collector as someone with a kind of a dubious moral character, well, that is probably not entirely unfair, we might say, at a basic level. These two men, in terms of the lives that they lead, are in total contrast to one another. That is quite right. But this is the crucial fact. The tax collector knows it. Everything the Pharisee wants to say of himself, that he is not, if you like, the tax collector knows himself to be. And he knows what that means for his relationship to God. And so he stands far off, you know, if you like, physically aware of the gulf that exists between him and God. He won't even look toward heaven, verse 13 tells us. Just like when you know that you've said or done something to hurt somebody, and you cannot bring yourself to look them in the eye. Now, he acknowledges his sin. He calls himself literally, actually there at the end of verse 13, the sinner. And he cries out to God for mercy. He comes to God and he pleads for help and for forgiveness because he knows how desperately he needs it. He knows that the only way that he can possibly be right with God is if God shows him grace, because he is thoroughly in the wrong. There's absolutely no question that this man comes thinking he has something to offer to God. There's no waving of his spiritual CV, no self-confidence in his own performance. Just an honest, real, desperate self-awareness and humility. I guess we often think of humility as being somehow fake. Humility is what, you know, Usain Bolt has to show when he talks about other athletes, even though we all know that actually he's really better than them. But true humility isn't a fabrication. True humility isn't pretend. No, true humility is a rightful acknowledgement of the facts. I would be humble about my athletic ability if I ever met Usain Bolt, because for me to talk myself up would be ridiculous. And so the tax collector shows humility before God because he knows that he must, because he is thoroughly in the wrong, because before God he has nothing. And this is the response. I tell you, this man went down to his house justified rather than the other. For everyone who exalts himself will be humbled, but the one who humbles himself will be exalted. Two little boys, Freddie and Tommy, are out in the back garden playing football. They know they're not supposed to play near the greenhouse, but they've ignored the instruction. And sure enough, one of them managed to hoof the ball over his pal's head, straight through the glass, and in amongst the tomato plants. The little boys head into the house where Mum, who has seen and heard absolutely everything through the kitchen window, is standing waiting. Freddie, the first little boy, runs up to Mum and stands, hands on hips, and shakes his head. Mum, he says, I want you to know that I'm really very good at football. I've been practicing a lot. I can control the ball with both my left foot and my right foot, and I'm also a very capable goalkeeper. Unfortunately, the same cannot be said of Tommy here. He is sloppy with his passing, he hits almost everything too high, and, it might also be noted, he has just managed to pump the ball through the window of the greenhouse. I tell you what, Mum, I bet you're glad I'm here to report on the whole thing. The other boy, Tommy, stands sheepishly by the kitchen door, stares at the ground, shifts, and his feet as a tear runs down his mucky face. Mum, he says, I know you told us not to play near the greenhouse, and I kicked the ball too high. I'm sorry. Which little boy does Mum hug? We are all disobedient children as we come before God. We have all ignored his instruction to us as to how we're to live with regard to him and how we're to treat other people. And our only hope is in his being merciful to us. And as we've been thinking about this evening, the wonderful promise of the gospel, the wonderful message of grace, the wonderful proof found at the cross is that God is absolutely desperate to show that mercy to us. God longs to be gracious and to show grace to those humble enough to ask for it. The question as we finish is, who are we of these two men? Who do we trust? Are we like the Pharisee, trusting in ourselves, persuading ourselves that we could stand before God if we were to meet him tomorrow on our own merit? Not asking for his mercy, but expecting his admiration. Presuming that we have somehow earned our standing before him? Or are we like the tax collector, honest enough to recognize ourselves as being totally in the wrong before God, and so falling at his feet to plead forgiveness, trusting not in ourselves, but in Jesus' work and in God's mercy on our behalf? Let's take a minute just to think about that in the quiet, to examine our own lives and our own hearts, to ask the question, if the world ended tomorrow, on what do I stand? My performance or God's grace? And if you want to use the time to pray, to admit to God our sin, you could use the words of the confession there again. And to praise him for his mercy, freely given through Christ. Now that would be no bad thing.
just take a minute. I tell you, this man went down to his house justified rather than the other. For everyone who exalts himself will be humbled, but the one who humbles himself will be exalted. Amen.